This is Turn It On.
And welcome to episode 48 of Turn It On. My name is Michael J., and you found my podcast. We are coming to you, as always, from beautiful Nashville, Tennessee, the center of the musical universe. Thank you so very much for joining me today. My lifelong friend, renowned author, psychotherapist, and expert on taming anxiety, Jodi Amon, is here on the program. But before we get to my chat with her, it's time for the Nobel Peace Prize winning segment of our show. Yes, folks, this is
Stories from the Road!
And that, of course, is the jingle for Stories from the Road, and it's never won a single award of any kind. Today's story comes to you from my time with my first band, Exploding Boy, as most of them do. We were busy touring the East Coast back in the late 90s, playing over 300 shows a year from Key West up to New York and New Jersey and as far west as Mississippi and Alabama. We used to do two-week residencies down in Key West, Florida at a place called Dirty Harry's. It was a really grueling schedule. We would play 4 hours or more a night, 7 nights on, 1 night off, and another 6 nights on. And during this time, the club housed us in 2 rooms above a club called the Red Garter, which was a strip club, obviously. And the entire complex was comprised of Dirty Harry's, which was the live music venue we played at. And there was also a sports bar and a dance club. Our typical night would usually end at around 3 or 4 a.m., at which time two or more of us in the band would generally wander around the corner to an all-night food place called the Green Iguana, where we would grab breakfast and stay out till about 5 or 6. And then we would sleep most of the following day, wake up around 2 or 3 in the afternoon, grab some food, get ready for the show. Rinse and repeat. And at the front end of the Dirty Harry's complex was a pizza place called Angelina's and a small sidewalk bar called the Tree Bar. And we were given locals discounts at these places. So our breakfast slash lunch was generally a slice or two of pizza from Angelina's. And I think they were like dollar slices or something like that. On this one early afternoon, I wandered down from our little room on the second floor to grab some pizza, and when I walked into Angelina's, I noticed a group of guys who were clearly in full-on celebration mode. They were doing a Key West thing of drinking what was referred to as a number 9. If you were a local or someone who was in the know, so to speak, you could walk into any place that served beer and ask for a number 9 and get a free small cup of beer. It wasn't exactly a shot, and it wasn't exactly a pint either. I'm not exactly sure whether this is still in practice down there or not, but there you go. Anyway, I had just woken up and was probably half hungover or still drunk from the night before, knowing me, so I didn't pay much attention to this group of guys kind of tearing it up until I looked over and locked eyes with one of them. And it was none other than Academy Award-winning actor Cuba Gooding Jr. He looked at me and I looked at him, and he realized that I recognized him, and he gave me a huge smile and said, "Hey, man." And I said, "Hey, Cuba Gooding Jr." And he said, "Yeah, you want to do a round of number 9s with us?" And so I said, "Sure." And he ordered another round of these small beers, and I joined their little group, and we raised them up and chugged them down. And I shook his hand, and we both kind of laughed, and he and his group left. I grabbed my slices of pizza and headed back up to the band room, not entirely sure whether what had just happened was real or not. It turns out that Cuba Gooding was there shooting a movie called A Murder of Crows, starring himself and Tom Berenger, which came out in 1998. That's a very random and funny moment from my past that I've never quite forgotten. We also have our first write-in story today, so you get two for the price of one, and as it turns out, that's free. This comes to you from my good friend Adam Flohmeyer, who was a guest on the program just a few episodes back. Adam is currently touring arenas playing guitar all over the U.S. and Canada with my old boss, Jameson Rogers, opening for Luke Combs on the Beer Never Broke My Heart tour. And Adam writes, "I was reminded of this because a Facebook time hop came up from 4 years ago. I played Madison Square Garden back in 2015 with a duo called Jukebox Mafia, opening for Miranda Lambert. It was me on acoustic guitar and backing vocals, and Dave Fenley on vocals and beatbox, which went through his loop pedal so he could sing over it. We got on our little side stage and nearly cried with the excitement of being able to play this world-renowned venue. Our set was 18 minutes of nonstop music, but for a brief 30 seconds or so during the show, it was just Dave a cappella. You see, during that moment, we lost power to our stage. This means his looper pedal, which was crucial to the set, went out, along with the stage lights. Thank God our PA was on different power, so we didn't lose guitar or vocals. The crew and I were frantically searching for what went wrong during the most scary 30 seconds of my life on the world's most iconic stage. Thankfully, we found a break in power signal and regained it just in time for Dave to come in with his booming beatbox. The day was saved. After the show, we proceeded to drink until 6 a.m. What a great day. Thanks for sending that in, Adam. If you have a story from the road that you'd like to share with the world, please send it in to me. You can email it to mj@tiopod.com. That is letter M, letter J at tiopod.com. Or you can reach me on the contact page of our website, tiopod.com. Either way is fine. It can be something that happened to you or someone you know, and it doesn't matter. And I don't care. I will read it out. And that, folks, is this week's twofer installment of
Stories from the Road.
Okay, as I mentioned earlier, my good friend Jody Amon is on the show today, and I could not be more thrilled or proud to have her on the program. As you'll hear in our talk, Jody was actually my high school girlfriend back when I was a senior, a long time ago. She went on to pursue a degree in social work and is now a published author, most notably of a book called You Won, Anxiety Zero. She's a psychotherapist and a counselor that's been helping people overcome all sorts of adversities in their lives for many, many years now. If you're a regular listener of the show, you might be asking yourself why I'm talking to a therapist this week instead of a musician or an artist of some sort. And the reason is this, and I mentioned this in our talk also. Insecurity, anxiety, and depression plague a large portion of the artistic community. I would argue that it is one of the main reasons that people like us do what we do in the first place. For me, it is definitely. And as some of you who listen to the show may know, I made the decision to stop drinking alcohol a few years back, and as a result, I've discovered that anxiety was at the root of a lot of my past destructive behavior. So I thought that having this discussion publicly on the show might be a help to many, if not all, of the members of my audience. Jody has an amazing take on things, and this talk is packed with helpful ideas as well as information on the multitude of resources she has available online to help you or maybe even someone you know who might be suffering or looking for some little bit of light to help get on track toward having a happier life. That is all in this talk. So I'm going to get out of the way here. This is me and my friend, Jody Amon. That sounds actually much better. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. Fantastic. Well, hi. How are you?
Hi, good.
Thank you so much for agreeing to do this. I guess I want to start off with getting a little bit of your background so that the listeners can get an idea of who you are and also my relationship with you and how we know each other. We go pretty much way back to when we were children.
Yes. Peter Pan.
Peter Pan. Right. We were in the Peter Pan play together. Went to school with your sister, and our families have known each other forever. We went to the same school and all that sort of business. So I got your book, You Won, Anxiety Zero, and I listened to it on audio because I do quite a bit of driving. And so that was the easiest way for me to do it. But I want to kind of give people an idea of how you got started being a counselor or a therapist. I'm not sure what term you prefer.
When I say therapist, people say what kind.
Right.
I don't understand that, but if I was a physical therapist, I'd say physical therapist, but people just ask that. So I always say psychotherapist, though I don't love that word, but like talk therapist, counselor, none of them are great. So I say psychotherapist, I guess, just because it's the clearest one, but people really don't know what that is.
Sure.
Because it's, you know, because we have psychology, psychotherapist, psychiatrist, you know, psychologist, and people just don't know what those terms are. So.
Right.
There's no good thing, actually.
Okay.
There's nothing good.
There's nothing good
to say.
Okay, bye.
But yeah, I you know, maybe that's part of it to explain that, because that's always the question you get.
Right.
But psychotherapist is not the credentials. My credentials are social work. Anyway, people ask that question. I just all the time.
Yeah, no, that's fine. That's fine. So I actually learned a lot of things about you that I didn't know. I had no idea that you struggled with anxiety as much as you did when you were younger.
I did so much. And since age five, as you read in the book,
right.
I was introduced, you know, to anxiety at that age. And actually, really before my 20s, I thought it was nausea. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know it was anxiety. Actually, when I was in grammar school, I was diagnosed with stomach migraines. Never hear of that?
No, yeah, and I've never heard of that.
My pediatrician actually said I had stomach migraines, but it was really anxiety. And I was so nervous I couldn't eat. And you couldn't be alone and hated the dark. And yeah, I had tons of problems. And it was when I was in high school, when I was a sophomore in high school, I wanted to be an architect. I love design, and I still love design and all that. I use it in different areas of my life. But I was volunteering in high school, and I worked, I helped a lot of people in volunteering, and I realized I could do that for a living. I could help people.
Right.
And so instead of going to architecture school, I went to in school for human services and social work. And so it really was back then, and I think in helping people, it healed me a lot. You know, when I volunteered and worked with the kids and I worked with the older people, I volunteered everywhere in high school. I think I was, you know, I was just really lost. I was just so lost, and nobody understood. And so when I was helping other people, it helped me so much. I found so much healing in that.
Yeah.
Them feeling worthy.
Right.
Reflects back. And I started there. Like, I never turned back. I've been doing this since high school, which is like 30 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I've just grown more and more in love with help, with working with people and being their witness.
Right.
It's pretty a sacred space that people let me into, you know?
Well, I was blown away in the book with just how much of a mastery you seem to have over the idea of anxiety. And that's, I think I explained to you when I asked you to do the show that part of the reason why I wanted to do this, it's normally a music-centric podcast, but being an artistic type of person, and I have, I'm sure a lot of the audience are artistic-minded people or musicians or artists or whatever, and anxiety is rampant with people like us. And there's so much to talk about. I almost don't know where to start. There's so much to unpack here, and we're never going to get to everything in the course of an hour. But I sort of figured that in maybe talking to you about some of these things and maybe giving some people that listen to the show an idea of where to find some of the resources that you have available, it may help some people. It may get some people thinking about it that maybe wouldn't have otherwise.
Yeah. Well, I think the message out there is that, you know, you just have to learn to live with anxiety, or anxiety is a mental illness and some people have it and some don't. And that's not how I see it at all. And I think that's the biggest revelation that I want to share, is that anxiety can happen to anybody and it is absolutely curable.
One of the topics that struck me in the book was that anxiety is always changing. Can we ever really put a stop to it, or do we have to keep evolving to combat it? Does that fight ever end?
I would say, so this is how I would, it depends on how you define anxiety, and people define anxiety different ways.
Sure.
That's what's so hard about it.
Sure.
Is because not only do people define anxiety different ways, they define a lot of, they use a lot of different words for it also.
Right.
Like embarrassment or OCD or shyness or overwhelm or resistance or whatever.
Sure.
Nervousness and so stress.
Right.
We use all these different words. And so what I've decided to define anxiety that helps. It's incredibly helpful to people. It's the leftover fear response when you're not in physical danger.
Okay.
So anxiety, because a lot of people say, oh, some anxiety is good because it helps you wear a helmet and put a seatbelt on. And I don't call that anxiety at all. That's common sense in my eyes.
Okay.
And if we call it anxiety, then we're not really sure if it's like rational fear, irrational fear. It confuses us so much. So if we get this common definition of anxiety, it's a leftover fear response when you're not in physical danger, then that means that you can have the fear response because that's biological, right?
Right.
We have adrenaline. Everybody's got adrenaline. Actually, there are some people who don't have that fear response. Very few, but usually it's caused by some other illness. But let's not talk about that. You know, for everyone else, we all have this fear response. that happens, and we're not going to get rid of the fear response, but we know what to do when it gets triggered, when we don't need it. 98% of the time, our fear response is triggered when we don't need it, like we're not in physical danger.
Right.
And if we get afraid of it, or if we make meaning around that, that something's wrong with us, that's what the anxiety is.
Right.
So anxiety is not the adrenaline or the symptoms of adrenaline in your blood. And there's all kinds of symptoms. We could talk about that if you want. But it's a leftover feeling that adrenaline gives you when you're not in danger. You don't need it anymore.
Another thing that you kind of touched on and mentioned was commercialism and how it relates to anxiety or depression. And I guess I've seen in with social media, I mean, you could kind of maybe equate social media and commercialism a bit. People only put on social media what they want people to see. It's not, they're not, they don't post, you know, I'm having a really terrible day, or this, I was really scared today, or really, maybe they do a little bit, but.
Now they do, yeah.
Yeah. Do you, have you seen a rise in.
Did you see my TEDx? Did you see my TEDx on my
I unfortunately, I have not had a chance to watch that yet.
Okay.
But yeah.
So everyone go and Google Jodi Amon TEDx, because it. I talk about this, and I'm going to do it now, but it's like we have 4,000 messages a day that we're dealing with. Like our kids even have 4,000 messages a day. And I feel like these messages bombard us with three very dangerous ideas that create this rampantness of anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
One, like I say in the talk about in the book, commercialism.
Right.
And one is this comparison culture.
Right.
So that, you know, all that social media stuff, comparing ourselves to others, like we're always going to be less than. And one is virtual trauma, because we see all this violence happening all over.
Right.
And let me talk about that commercialism, because it's really. It's exciting, I think, because it's an understanding that I came to see just in talking to people. But, you know, we have, and it's different from when we were young. I mean, we still had a bit of work ethic, you
right.
know, when we
yeah,
were growing
right.
up. And our kids have glossed that a little bit. There's this entitlement, and it's like they feel like such they have to protest all this oppression of having to, like, work hard, you know, that the millennials, everyone's talking about them.
Mm-hmm.
And I really see that as a product of commercialism. Instead of blaming parents, my goodness, there's all of these commercials constantly that are telling kids, you know, get this because it's cool and you deserve it.
Right.
Because companies want kids to just buy, or anybody, all of us, we're affected by it still, but we didn't have it as from when we were little.
Right.
There's commercials everywhere on every surface right now. And they're all saying, you deserve this. So kids are not learning cause and effect.
Mm-hmm.
They think that you just get stuff.
Right.
And so but we don't just get stuff. You don't always have the money to get stuff, and not everyone gets stuff. And so kids are really confused by this.
Yeah.
They don't understand, because they're kind of told this message is constant that they should just, everyone deserves it.
Right.
And so they conclude, like, they don't understand, they don't see cause and effect, like you have to work for it to get it. And they conclude that they must not get it because they're not worthy. And I started, you know, you ever hear of, you know, in the grocery store, if the kid wants that toy and then they just start screaming.
Oh, sure.
Like they're really feeling like they're unworthy of it. In that moment, they feel like a sense of like they're unworthy of that thing.
Right.
It's not that, that's what they're grieving. And it doesn't matter, like, once they get home, that thing is worthless. It just is to show their worth in that moment, you know?
Sure.
And then it's like in the bottom of a closet, and you're like, oh.
Right.
And they want the next thing, because it's the acquiring of it that gives them worth, not the value of the entertainment of
yeah,
it or
exactly.
anything else. And so kids are not learning this cause and effect, and so they feel inherently worthless and powerless. Like, they don't know how. They don't know why they're worthless.
Right.
Because no one's told them. So this powerlessness, this helplessness, this not understanding, that is leading us all to feel worthless, powerless, out of control. And that's why anxiety is so rampant. The commercialism is a huge reason. Obviously, the virtual trauma is easy to understand. I mean, we used to, when we experienced hardships, we were in the process and our fear response went up and we had the adrenaline to actually do something.
Right.
Now we're sitting on our couch or looking at our phone and we can't do anything. This horror happens. And again, it seems random because you don't see anything leading up to it. You just see the scene with people running and bloody. And then the comparison culture. So these three very dangerous messages that are coming and bombarding us constantly are leading us to feel powerless and worthless. I'd love to say more about that comparison culture, because, you know, we're living in this Western world, these operations of modern power, where we're trying not to, we want to belong.
Right.
So we have to measure up to these social standards, you know, that we have to make sure we're good enough, smart enough, thin enough, beautiful enough, young enough. And we have to measure up, or else we are like on the outside.
Sure.
And which is scary, you know,
yeah.
We're social beings. We want to be, we need, our souls need to be belong, you know, and the most devastating thing is to think you aren't. And we don't even know what these standards are. Like, what's the best wife? How do you be the best wife or musician or artist or whatever? And so you have to shoot higher than it. And just destroys you.
Well, right. It's incredibly daunting, because now the competition is global. And to some degree, I read something somewhere, and I'm not sure where it was, but they were talking about the fact that our social groups as human beings were never meant to be as large as they are, maybe are now.
Oh, globally.
Yeah, like our peer groups or whatever are enormous now with social media and with the way our communications are and our television and everything. You know, it's overwhelming.
Yeah, we always feel like we're in the back of the pack.
Right.
We're all in the middle of the pack, but we always feel like we're in the back because we see those people. You know, we just have this deficit mentality from this comparison that we're doing. And if we don't meet those standards, we're just constantly failing. And that's why we all feel like we're not enough.
Yeah.
And so then we have this deficit, we just see our deficits constantly. And, you know, you just see what you didn't do. You did all this stuff today and just amazing stuff. And we just see what we didn't do.
Well, yeah. Right. And somebody else told me something about the fight or flight response. I know you talked a little bit about that too. And we live in the best time that it's ever been for human beings to live. We have all the comforts. I mean, not everybody in the world, but the majority of us do. And somebody was, again, I don't know where I saw this. I wish I could reference it more properly, but somebody had said something about the fight or flight response having no purpose anymore. And so the chemicals that used to prompt us to do that kind of don't have anywhere to go, and there's no purpose to them anymore. So,
well, I think there's still like a 2% of the time that that's what the statistics say.
Sure.
And I don't know where this came from, so I shouldn't be quoting it necessarily, but there is sometimes when like you almost get hit by a car, and yeah, by the time you're flooded with adrenaline, maybe the car has passed and you're safe already.
Right.
But it's not inappropriate, you know, but there's so much of the time. Do you mind if I talk about the biology?
No.
Because this blows people away and it's really helpful. But so there's the amygdala. That's like this part of your brain. It's like an almond shaped cluster, like right in the middle. And the amygdala is the center that triggers your brain to release the adrenaline, and it works on emotion. Because our thoughts are way too slow and the motion is faster. And so sometimes the trigger is something that we don't even realize. It could be a smell, a sound, just a feeling in your body. And it could be so slight, but it's like, oh my God, what if I get anxious right now? Sometimes that's a thought that comes. Sometimes your body's flooded with adrenaline before you get that.
Right.
And it had to do this for evolution, like for survival. It had to be fast. You had to be ready by the time your cortex, your prefrontal cortex is the thinking part of your brain. And before that gets involved, like you need to be ready.
Yeah.
And so it sends this message like rapidly. I mean, this is like in evolution. This message system is just amazing to get to the prefrontal cortex. And the prefrontal cortex has to look around and say, okay, am I in danger? No. I mean, if you're being abused, like you do need that adrenaline to hyper-focus and get strong. And I mean, we do use our adrenaline sometimes. Actually, a lot of times we use it. So I don't want to knock the fear response. It's amazing what our body does.
Sure.
You know, like I think you can lift the car off somebody if we needed
to.
Right. When I was in a car accident, my baby son was in the back seat and my husband couldn't open the door. I like pushed him out of the side and ripped the freaking door off to get to my baby. You know, I really think that was adrenaline. And I was in the park and I was a victim of like a gang initiation. I got knocked off my bike. And I mean, my adrenaline, I stood up in stance, like ready to, you know, be powerful and fight them off. And we do use our adrenaline. So, but anyway, so what happens nowadays is, so if your prefrontal cortex looks around and says everything's fine, the message system going back to the amygdala is not as strong. Like in evolution, we didn't really need that to survive. And so it didn't develop the same way the other direction.
Okay.
And so we have to do the heavy lifting. Like we have to say, okay, thanks amygdala. I'm okay. But if I need to do that, be pretty cool, but I don't need you right now. We have to do that. But this is what I see happening, Mike, all the time, is that the amygdala gets triggered. Mm-hmm. It sends that information to the body and the body's like ready. You know, we know like all our blood goes to our extremities. That's why we have stomach ache, because all the blood leaves our stomach. And, you know, we get tunnel vision and we get all this energy to prefrontal cortex to find the problem. What happens is it's like our body's ready and the message goes to the prefrontal cortex, and the prefrontal cortex is now looking around and it says, I don't see any danger, but I feel it. So keep pumping those hormones out.
Sure.
So you see what's happening is like you need to be afraid of it, right? So the anxiety and the fear of the feeling,
right,
actually is re-triggering the amygdala over and over. And that's why I call anxiety the leftover fear response when you're not in physical danger.
Right.
So knowing that now, if you think about it, like in the caveman times, there's a dangerous animal in the woods. And, you know, if you saw it, you'd be like, and you'd your adrenaline would go off and you'd run, or you'd throw your lunch over there. So the animal would chase your lunch and you'd run back to the village.
Sure.
When you got back to the village, you'd be like out of breath, but you'd be telling everyone the story. There'd be a little excitement, but the adrenaline, there wouldn't be that anxiety. It'd be gone. We used up the adrenaline fighting and running away.
Right.
And so once you start to take action, there's no point of the fear anymore. Like there's just no point of it anymore.
Right.
You take action. The energy goes into the action. So knowing those two things, knowing that biology, anytime anyone feels any anxiety, they need to remember just two things. So if we know the biology of it, all you need to know is you can't be afraid of it.
Sure.
And you have to take some kind of action, because action releases the GABA hormone. It's going to put the brakes on the adrenaline.
Okay.
So the GABA hormone stops your adrenaline, and it stops it within less than a minute if it was to come out. So did anyone ever startle you? Like you didn't know they were coming in
yeah.
the room
oh,
and
sure.
you're like, you know,
right.
and you jump and everyone laughs,
yeah.
you know, because it's
yep.
really funny
yeah, right,
and
right.
screams, you know?
Right.
The adrenaline, that's adrenaline, but it goes away so fast for everybody because they know immediately they're safe.
Right.
And they're laughing and they're not afraid of it. And for some reason, that triggered of anxiety, that trigger of adrenaline, usually everyone could relate how fast that goes away.
Right.
That's how fast the adrenaline would go away if you knew you were safe.
Yeah. A lot of these things, I mean, I know for myself personally, they're irrational. I mean, it's all irrational stuff. And that's, you talk a lot about that in the book. We've seen so many suicides of celebrities, everybody from, well, like Robin Williams to like going back as far as Kurt Cobain, Chris Cornell, Anthony Bourdain, Chester Bennington. There's a list a mile long of people who looked like they had everything. And
right.
I don't know how many of those things were drug related, but there had to be certain distortions in their makeups that they weren't dealing with properly. Do you have any thoughts on that at all?
Yeah. I mean, it's so sad because I wish, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure they were working with some people. And I do a lot of quotes for articles and stuff.
Uh-huh.
A lot of freelancers call me. And one time somebody asked me, you know, from my experience, if any of my clients committed suicide, and I haven't had any clients commit suicide in 25 years. So thank goodness.
Right.
But I don't know if it's, you know, coincidence. I'm lucky. I mean, I've worked with 35 people a week. So for 25 years. And I think I'm just hoping that it was something I did. Maybe, I don't know. You never
sure,
know.
Sure.
But I would just wish people had someone to talk to. And I think when people hold it in, I can't assume that that they didn't have anyone to talk to or whatever. But I know for people who are listening, if they have those kind of thoughts, it's always better to talk to someone that you could trust. That's always you know, one of the things that you could do. And unfortunately, people feel so alone or ashamed. And so they choose not to do that.
Right.
And then it's tragic. It's tragic for, you know, everybody involved, actually. It's really sad. One time when a young girl, actually, you and I had a friend in high school. Yesterday was his date, right? His date of death.
Oh, was that really? Was it Mike?
Mike Philippe, yeah.
Yeah, Mike Philippe, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that was that was crazy.
March 25th. I'll never forget the day, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was really sad.
No, I remember that. I mean, that was the first, you know, unfortunately, there's been more since then, but that was the first person I really, you know, I really knew that took their own life. I lost somebody a few years ago. One of my ex-girlfriends took her life, and you were incredibly kind. I think you reached out to me almost right away, and you said something that struck me and that stuck with me and that I've since imparted to other friends of mine who've known people who've taken their lives. And that was this. And, you know, usually the response from people when someone takes their life is, oh, what a selfish thing to do. And you told me specifically, you said, this is something that they think that they're unburdening the people around them by doing this. They're not, it's not a selfish thing. It's actually the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
And
absolutely.
Yeah. Can you expound upon that at all?
Yeah. I think that, you know, that kind of loss is so difficult for all the loved ones. And there is this discourse that they were sick. And in that, it's like more of a separation from who they knew, you know. So there's someone that they knew that they loved, who had values, who loved them back, who, you know, who they respected and honored. And all of a sudden they're sick. It's like a disconnection. So they can't, they're just disconnected. And when people lose someone, they want to feel connected to who they knew.
Right.
And so when I'm interviewing someone who had a loss like that, you know, when they're telling me about the person's values, it's usually pretty clear. And I've known, I mean, I haven't had any clients commit suicide, but I've had many, many, most of them think about it. And I've thought about it in my life also. And so I understand it. I understand when people have that desire. And so I've heard that from a person's mouth, but I also, in interviewing, wanting to connect who they knew with what their values are, so that you could stay connected to her.
Sure.
And not feel like that this sickness that caused them to complete suicide, like they were different than who you knew.
Right.
And but I believe that it's not a tactic, or it's not like a technique or anything. I know, because I've talked to people in that situation, and they really feel like they love you so much that they don't want to burden you anymore. Or moms who love their kids that much. It seems, I'll be dangerous if I stay, or like husbands and fathers who think, I'll be dangerous to my family if I stay.
Right.
And I really feel like they make the choice to save their families. And it's a different way to look at it, but I've known it to be true.
Where do you think the disconnect is with those people? Do you think, I mean, like, they're obviously not in their right minds when they do this. They're not thinking clearly at all. Can that be sort of relegated to a chemical imbalance that's just not properly being medicated, or maybe medicated in the wrong way?
It's possible. I think that you know, a lot more evidence is showing that people who use antidepressants, there's side effects. Sometimes they're miracles and they help people survive, but I think a lot of times they make people worse. And we're starting to see the research showing that.
Uh-huh.
So sometimes I wonder, you know, you're labeled, and then you're, you know, you're chronically mentally ill, and then you can't do anything about it. Like, you lose all of your agency. You feel powerless.
Right.
And so some of it's mental, but some of it, I think, physiological.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of the violent act, not all of them, but a lot of the violent acts, the people are under some influence of either you know, prescription medicine or not prescription medicine.
Right.
And so that, you know, that does change our self. But I feel like the the loneliness and isolation is so powerful, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
And feeling like nobody understands.
Right.
And so when you are at the point and you feel like I am so different, it's devastating.
Mm-hmm.
And then you isolate yourself more because you feel so different and like you're a burden on everybody and nobody gets it and you're messed up because you can't, you know, pull yourself together or whatever. It's so the devastation, like on our soul and on our psyche is so big. And so then we isolate ourselves and it gets worse. Then you're stuck in your head,
right,
rolling around those negative thoughts, and it just gets so, so powerful, and it could get incredibly powerful. And if somebody is impulsive, you know, then they succeed.
Right.
And sometimes, you know, it, just not being as impulsive or that moment helps save someone's life. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, it's really, it's devastating, but they're not trying to, it's not about getting attention or like they're so alone,
right,
and heavy and feeling misunderstood and not understanding themselves. And it's like you don't want to live like that.
Well, something you just said kind of struck me too, that you said that they feel so different. And something else you mentioned in your book is that pretty much human beings are by and large the same, that certain people are just better at hiding these things than others. We look at somebody who, well, I'll use Robin Williams as an example. You look at a guy like that and you think he's got his life in order and he's got everything together. And when in fact, the exact opposite is true. Insecurity is rampant in the music business, and
right,
I always kind of joke that I have a good handle on it. Some people that I know don't necessarily,
yeah,
but
right.
But when I see
you're picked over the competition, you're on stage, so everyone's looking at you. I mean, there's like different aspects of it, right?
Exactly, exactly.
You make a mistake in front of everybody. I mean,
yeah, no, that's,
you don't get picked for that group, or
you could wear the wrong T-shirt. Comes down to that,
yeah,
kind of thing. But I've seen,
right,
the people that are the most confident sometimes. Not confident, that's probably the wrong word. The people that are the most arrogant, I should say, or the people that are a bit cocky about what they do. To me, I always view that as extreme insecurity that's turned outward. There's a lot of people that are very good at hiding those things. And I think for those of us like me, who's, I'm an open book. I don't know, I have a podcast where I talk about myself all the time. So,
yeah, it's awesome.
You know, it is, it can be difficult because, yeah, like everybody that I see, I'm like, oh, that guy's got his act together or that girl's got her act together. And you sort of
know. Everyone looks like that from the outside. Right,
right, right, right. Exactly.
Everybody looks like that, but none of them are, you know, and you do too. Well, you're open book, but you know, I always tell people that. I'm like, you know, does anyone look at you and know what you're going through? No, no one would ever know. I'm like, then everyone else is walking around the same way. Like, what makes,
well,
you,
right,
think that they're,
right,
really okay just because they look okay? Because no one would ever know how much pain you're in.
Right.
No one would know. And so I'm someone who people told secrets to for 25 years. I know they're all in their head and insecure.
Right.
And I know they're all, because they've grown up in Western culture. We're all like this. And I mean, that whole chemical imbalance thing, I mean, that was a metaphor they used to sell pharmaceuticals back in the 70s, or that metaphor with diabetes. It's, they called them out of it and they couldn't use that in their marketing anymore. But doctors are still telling their patients that, like 40 years later,
right,
they're still using that metaphor. And it, you know, our chemicals, like chemicals or hormones, which is what the chemicals in our body actually are, they're hormones.
Mm-hmm.
Are changing constantly all the time. We're never in any balanced state. I mean, it's just constantly changing. So when you say some people are imbalanced, that's not a true metaphor. They use that at one point to describe something, and there's nothing that really, that's not based on anything,
right,
that's real. I mean, definitely people are sad and heavy. Do you want to hear another?
Yes. Yeah.
Thing that I just, okay. So, this is really fascinating, I think, is because I was actually studying marketing when I heard about this. But the brain has two functions.
Okay.
So one is to survive and thrive, obviously.
Sure.
Right? It wants to survive, right? Okay. And the second function of the brain, the goal, I mean, like the goal of the brain is to conserve calories. So if it considers anything that they have to do that's not surviving and thriving, it's going to have some resistance.
Okay.
Now, this has effect on everything in our life. Like, we don't want to get out of bed. Don't you feel that resistance, like anything you have to do that's hard?
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Do you feel it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Everyone does.
Right.
Everyone does. But if you, when you feel it, you think you're the only one who feels it. So every time you have to do a chore or do something hard, you get this resistance. Like, I don't feel like doing that. And then we make all kinds of meaning around that. Like, what's wrong with me? I'm tired all the time. I don't want to do anything. I'm not motivated. And it, think about how this compounds over and over day by day. Mm-hmm. Is you think that you're different. Everyone else could do stuff and I can't do stuff.
Right.
And so you think of yourself. So I think a lot of mental illness comes out of the meaning we make around this very natural biological thing that our brain does.
Huh.
And so I'm starting to really share this because it's changing people's lives to realize, oh, that's normal.
Right.
I resist stuff. Even the motivated people, they get the same feeling. They just out-trick their brain. All day long, I do a lot of stuff. I'm very productive. I have to out-trick my brain all freaking day.
Yeah.
But people who've been depressed for a really long time, they're like, but I can't do it.
Right.
Like, that's what you've thought for so long. And you feel so different. That feeling different is so devastating. And it's so powerful. So think about over years and years and years of feeling down on yourself, hating yourself, feeling that resistance so you don't want to do anything, the heaviness, the exhaustion of it.
Right.
Over a year, and the isolation that happens because you feel unworthy of anybody. You feel powerless and out of control. This is what we're all experiencing, this
right.
depression and anxiety that we're all experiencing. And it's, if we understood ourselves a bit, we'd be a lot easier on ourselves. And I think things could be a lot different. And so I'm just like sharing it wherever I can, you know, it's mind-blowing.
Yeah. Maybe give me a sense a little bit of a couple of the tactics maybe that you use to kind of turn anxiety on its head and to get people kind of kicked out of that. Like, there was one example you gave of a girl who was afraid to throw up, and I was laughing really hard at that because I could picture you. You I forget what it was called, but you made her watch videos of men throwing up on a roller coaster, and which is hilarious. It sounds funny. In fact, I have to confess, I went to YouTube right away.
Did you laugh so hard?
I did.
I couldn't even finish the thought. I was laughing so hard.
Yeah.
It's really funny.
But it is one of those things, like, I mean, where if you can get somebody to laugh, generally, yeah, they're forgetting about the fact that, you know, what they were afraid of in the first place is really ridiculous.
Right. Right. Laughter and anxiety can't live the same moment together, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And I found that very interesting. But are there some other things that you can maybe touch on in brief that would make sense, that like approaches that you take maybe to kind of...
Yeah, well, I mean, I outlined 6 steps to getting rid of anxiety. And that first one is understanding it biologically, which basically I covered. And I want to tell you that about 50% of the people get rid of their anxiety just understanding that, because it's so mysterious. And that's why it's so scary.
Right.
And we get it. So that's step one, because it just eliminates a lot.
Yeah.
And then when you get to step two, it's like understanding the lies that it tells, because anxiety lies constantly. It says you can't make decisions, you can't handle it, it's going to be awful. It tells us all these terrible things, and it's pretty evasive, but it's like they're scary. You're like, oh no, I don't want that to happen. I better like stay home and not do anything. So learning the lies, and in the book, I do outline 15 lies that
right.
common lies that anxiety tells people.
Right.
And when you understand them through the stories I tell, it's like, oh my gosh, it does this to me. Then you realize, like, if you don't believe it, anxiety has no more power. And that's why I want to expose the lies. So the third step is learning your control that you have, like getting in touch with your personal agency.
Mm-hmm.
Your personal agency is like you're an agent in your life, and you could affect, you know, things happen to you.
Sure.
But your response to them is more important than what happened.
Right.
Like to your mood, to your happiness in life, to your fulfillment, to your relationships. Your response means like all of it.
Right.
What happens to you is very little. It's how you think about it, what you do next, the relationships you have and nurture and all that stuff. That's what makes your life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I outline like 15 common skills and abilities that my clients we've listed out over the years. Like when I work with people, you know, we list out the lies that anxiety tells and the skills that they have. And it's like, wow. So step 4 is forgiveness. because our being down on ourselves and judging ourselves so much, we judge ourselves so much. I mean, that's from that comparison culture.
Sure.
And
the
standards that we're living up to. But we don't trust ourselves and everything feels out of control. We don't trust ourselves. We don't think we can handle anything.
Right.
So that's step four, is really making peace and being more gentle with yourself, having self-compassion.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the favorite things I teach. Number five is daily practices, like self-care practices, like meditate, eat right, sleep enough, that kind of
thing.
We all know that.
Sure, sure.
You know, we exercise. I mean, we all know how to take care of ourselves, but that's it. And then the last one is strategic affirmations, like changing beliefs. It's all about beliefs.
Right.
You know, all of what we feel in our life, all of our emotion state, our psyche, and our spiritual state, and everything is all about what we believe. And when you have beliefs that kind of limit you or are negative, you need to change them. And people try to change them too drastically.
Mm-hmm.
But I teach them like the smaller steps to get there, because you can't change a belief. You can't just be like, I love you, I love you, I love you to yourself in the mirror if you really hate yourself.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
It's too much of a gap. And so you have to do it slowly. And so those are the six steps. And, you know, what makes me different about other people who talk about anxiety is, like, I take the power of anxiety down. Most people are just teaching the skills.
Right.
That's only one of my steps. The rest of it is like breaking down the power of anxiety and then really getting in touch and having compassion and loving yourself.
Right.
And then you're good to go. I mean, then you have a happy life. I mean, I've trained myself in these happy habits, and, you know, I went from like totally depressed and not wanting to get out of bed till like, you know, pretty happy.
Yeah. It's, you know, again, with my own situation and my own anxiety and stuff like that, I found your book incredibly helpful, and I'm planning on doing a review and probably a review after the review.
Awesome.
Because I think those things, I think they're helpful for everyone. So
we should have just did counseling on that podcast.
We should have you.
counsel you.
We'll do a counseling session every week. Yeah. You need to get paid. I'm a musician. but I said, I found things in there that I really enjoy how you refer to anxiety as almost a separate entity outside of yourself or outside of whoever was experiencing it, because in that way, it's sort of like it gives you, to me, it was like, it gives me power over it because it's not me, you know, like it'd be easier to kind of, and I took a lot away from that. So.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I mean, it's our identity, right? And then it's devastating to have anxiety as your identity.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And, you know, we make these negative identity conclusions on ourselves. And if you realize anxiety is something that's influenced you, you have different identity, then you're like a kind person and you're a creative musician and you do a podcast and you're a hard worker and you're a good friend and a good son. You know, I mean, you have a lot of different identities, but when you have something like anxiety as your identity, like it's a dominant, you can't, you know, it's hard to connect with all the other pieces of you.
I have to sort of publicly thank you once again for when my ex-girlfriend Lisa killed herself. It was, I mean, it's still, I'm still not, you know, I don't know whether I'll ever be past it or over it, but you were incredibly, incredibly gracious and incredibly kind to me. And you have been right along, but for that, specifically. And, so I want to say thank you for that because it's helped me kind of move past it. In fact, it's, you know, sort of a spring, it's been a springboard for me. I've changed as a person almost 100% since that happened. I stopped drinking. I'm eating better. I'm taking better care of myself. And I don't know if some of that's probably the, you know, the fear of like, I don't want that to happen to me. But you were very kind and you helped me understand a little bit more what maybe her motivations were and be forgiving to her. Cause you know, the kind of the first knee jerk reaction is anger. And I'm not really angry. Yeah. I'm upset. It just seems like such a waste to me that she did that, but I look at it in a different way now. And I don't know if you probably don't know this, but I was actually giving your website information out for a number of podcasts after that. Cause I talked about it at the beginning of one of the shows, talked with a guy named Corey Cox, and I did it on that show intro. And it was a very emotional thing that I kind of second guessed myself and thought maybe I shouldn't put this in, but then I left it in the intro because it was about as raw and honest as you get. And if then this show doesn't work if I'm not and if my guests aren't.
Yeah.
So people can go back and listen to that if you want. But I was actually giving out your info. So I want to find out a little bit more, like maybe to tell people where they can find the various resources that you have available online and all that kind of thing.
Sure. I do want to say, like, I've known Mike for a long time, and do you go by Michael? Am I calling you Mike?
You can. You're one of those select few people that can get away with calling me Mike because we've known each other for so long.
Okay. I'm sorry about that.
No. That's fine. That's fine.
Yeah. Because I know your heart, and I know you're such a good person, and I remember. So I knew Mike when you dated her back in college, and I knew she was in pain back then, and I knew the light that Mike was. You and for so many people, I saw it over and over in your life, and even with me when we were friends, we're still friends. but you were just the light. You really came in people's life when they really needed that light, and you were that for her. It's just so it's so inspiring to me to watch it.
Oh, well,
and
that's...
to watch you with such kindness and big heart, like really help people when they're in their lowest state always. And you changed her life, and that, you made so much goodness in her life on account of that relationship that you had. And so I saw it.
Well, that's very nice and very sweet of you to say. I guess let people know where they can, find your stuff.
Sure, yeah, I have a website. My book, if you like the sound of my book, I think it's really good. I just have to get the word out a little bit more. I got a book contract, did you hear, Mike, about teenagers, which, I had a...
Congratulations.
Thank you. That was, You Want Anxiety Zero self-published, and it's done fantastic, but I had a publishing company, and they approached me, so I didn't have to do the shopping for agents or anything, and
that's amazing.
I have a contract to write a book for teenagers, but so my website's jodiaman.com, jodiaman.com, and I have a YouTube channel. I have hundreds of videos on YouTube. I'm all over social media, but everything you could find, from that website, jodiaman.com. I have lots of online master classes and I still work privately with people. So,
and do you do counseling sessions for, so if somebody wanted to do a counseling session with you, like via, Skype or FaceTime, do you do that kind of thing, or do you just private practice kind of thing?
Yep.
Oh, you do?
No, I do. I work with people all over the world.
Okay. Well, that's great. That's a way that somebody can, if somebody listening is feeling like they need, some help, Jody's the person. And I want to tell a funny story here, because one thing I didn't say is that you and I dated briefly when we were children, when we were in high school.
It was like a year. That wasn't brief. Well, in high school, I mean, that's a long time.
Okay. So a year. But I was thinking today.
My first love.
Oh, God.
Well, we were little. We were so little. I was a junior in high school.
I was a senior. So the funny thing is, I was thinking about the fact that I was going to talk to you tonight. I remembered this, and I'm not sure if you remember it the same way or not, but we went to your junior prom together, and your dad at the time owned a very, very nice car. It was a Jaguar, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
And
it was my mom's.
Oh, it was your mom's car. Okay, okay. But I remember I did think your dad handed me the keys. Like, I'd been driving, we were maybe 16, 17 at the time, maybe 18-ish. And do you remember this, what I'm going to say? So your dad handed me the keys, and this was, I think this was sometime in like April or May or something like that. So your dad handed me the keys and like, hey, I'm going to let you drive the Jag tonight. And I was thinking, oh God, I was instantly nervous. And so with all the parents in the driveway, you and I got in the car, and I started it, and it was so quiet when I started it that I tried to start it again, and it did that kind of thing. And I just thought, oh no. And that, I remember driving home that night, it snowed. It snowed in like late April, early May in Rochester. And I'll never forget that, because I was thinking, oh my God, don't crash the car, don't crash the car. And again, I'd had maybe a year of driving experience under my belt. So, so kind of funny.
I don't remember that starting. I mean, I remember the junior prom, and I don't remember it snowing.
You remember?
It snowed on my senior ball, which was June 1st. It snowed.
Yeah, welcome to Rochester.
But we were together
then. Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Lake effect.
Yeah, right. Well, honestly, Jody, thank you so much for taking the time out to do this. It means the world to me. And
anytime.
I know it's going to help a bunch of people. Just to hear these things talked about, to hear them verbalized is helpful, I think. And that was, again, my purpose in doing this is I thought, well, a bunch of us artist types could probably every now and again use a little talking to.
Yeah. And I help people. I don't help people just with anxiety. I mean, I help people with anything.
Sure.
Start from where they're at and go. I talk about this stuff because it's basic stuff that really helps people quickly. So.
Right. Well, it's been awesome to kind of watch you from afar on social media and see. It's just great. It's very nice to, you know, like when my friends do well, and it's great to see that you're doing so well.
Yeah, thank
and
you.
And all that. So
it's great to see you doing so well.
I am doing my best. I'm trying. It's in Nashville can eat you up, but it's good. Yeah, things at the moment, I can't really complain. So it's very good. But
awesome.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Jody. I really appreciate it. And that was awesome. That was fantastic.
Thank you.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed my chat with Jody, and I really hope you all got something out of it. My huge thanks to her for taking time out of her incredibly busy schedule to be on the show today. My goal was to leave you hopeful and inspired, and so hopefully this episode did that for you. Jody already gave you her website info, but I'm going to do it again here. You can access all her resources and all of her social media on her website, jodiaman.com. That is JODIAMAN.com. Please go check out everything she has available, and I'm also going to post her info in the show notes for today's program on our website, TIOpod.com, so go check that out as well. Do me a favor, give me a follow on the socials. I'm at Michael J. Music on Facebook and Twitter, and I'm at Michael J. Official on Instagram. We also have a PayPal donation button on our website, TIOpod.com. Drop us a few bucks if you're so inclined to help us keep the show free and to help keep the equipment running over here. You don't have to donate, but I'd love you forever if you did. And if you enjoy the show, consider checking out any one of the previous 47 episodes that we have available, and please help spread the word. At the moment, this show is not generating any income for me, but it would be amazing if it did. And all it's going to take is enough word of mouth, enough downloads, enough subscriptions, and enough positive reviews to help attract sponsors our way. And maybe, just maybe, I can start making some of my living doing this. Here's hoping anyway. There's another show headed your way next week, and after that we'll be hitting the 50 episode mark. Hard to believe, but I'm both very excited and very proud. There's something special coming your way for the 50th episode, so come back for that for sure. And thanks so very much to all of you for listening, and I'll see you again here next time on Turn It On.